This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features Karim Hussein, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong of the CSC. This interview was recorded in Toronto on September 10th, 2018.
Karim Hussein, CSC, and we're going to have a little convo. So, can you tell me where you, like, where did you go to film school?
No, I come from, hi everybody, by the way, pleasure to be here. Yeah, no, I came from underground horror cinema, basically. I've been a horror fan since I could remember, very, very young. That was one of my main catalysts. I mean, movies in general, obviously, but the horror genre is particularly the thing that I've been obsessed with and still continue to be for a long time. And I started off doing underground movies in Super 8 film when I was a kid. The first movie I made, I was 7 years old. And the old trajectory, it's a very different trajectory now, but for young people. But back then, you would take your parents' Super 8 camera and you would go and shoot, and then you would go on the rewind table and you would cut your reversal film that you learned all your mistakes from, because there was no latitude whatsoever.
So, but you just on your own just decided I wanted to make films, and you just figured it out.
Well, I just always knew that I was going to do it, and I went to the library. I got a few books that I still follow some of the rules in those books today, and just went out and did it. And, you know, had been doing odd jobs to be able to pay for my film stock and my development, because if you were using Ektachrome 160, the development was not included. Kodachrome 40, it was, but, you know, it took forever to get back, and you might not even get back your rushes. You might get back someone else's film. So that was always the complicated thing with Kodachrome 40. But Ektachrome, yes, you had to pay. So you had to pay not only to shoot it, you had to pay to develop it and things like that. So, you know, I would work in video stores, fruit stores, things like that. I am of the sort of VHS cinema education generation, where that obsession and a lot of these foreign art house genre movies really formed sort of a lot of the way I did it. And that, and I read, I mean, American Cinematographer magazine was one of my multiple Bibles. My two, you know, sort of learning Bibles were Fangoria magazine and American Cinematographer magazine. Those were the two.
So I guess that's why in earlier in your career you did some directing as well.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people when they start out, they all want to direct when you're some sort of arrogant young fool as I was, who learned great lessons of one should not direct unless they're particularly only able to do that, you know, and then great. But yeah, I started off always shooting my own movies, always DPing my own movies. In the case of the first feature I did, which took 6.5 years to complete from the first day of shooting to the completion of it. It was started in 1994 and came out in 2000.
What was that one called?
It's a movie called Subconscious Cruelty. It was a 16mm feature that was only released theatrically in Canada, thankfully, in very small pockets. But it was a huge hit in Japan on video, and ended up triggering not in the way triggering is used today, but you know, ended up enabling, let's say, the financing of my second feature, which was on 35mm and all the trimmings. But you know, this movie Subconscious Cruelty was made in all of the old techniques. It was shot on standard 16mm, cuts initially on a light box with rewinds for the rough cuts. Then as it advanced, we cut the movie on an upright 1950s Moviola machine. So we were too poor to even afford A-wind. The movie was on B-wind, that any old film people will understand what that means. So we were too broke to even afford A-wind. We did it on a Moviola, like real old school. And 16mm Moviolas, man, that could tear your film like there was no tomorrow. So we cut that for a while. And, you know, we shot a month in, this is in Montreal. We shot a month based on some private investment that Mitch Davis, my producer of it, was able to put together. And of course, all the money was spent immediately in that first month. There was no money left. So we would occasionally go try to scramble some money, shoot another weekend. And this process went on for a number of years. Then during that process, the negative was stolen by the sort of dishonest production manager who put the negative in the lab under their name. So we had to pay ransom money to get the negative out. We were totally broke. And this was like the early 90s when everybody was a junkie. Everybody was...
in Montreal.
Yeah. And everybody was like into serious like subversion. Like to make a movie, this kind of underground horror movie, subversion was okay. You know, not unlike today, which subversion is frowned upon. So we were doing this picture kind of piecemeal as it went along, and then ultimately we were able to finish it, blow it up to 35 mil. I cut the sound myself also. It was, for us, a huge thing. We cut on a Fostex Foundation sound editor, which was really huge in 1989. It was like the first digital sound editing machine, and all the work prints were cut by hand, obviously, because we'd done with the mag stock and everything. So ultimately, the movie was blown up to 35 mil in direct blow-ups because we couldn't afford to do an interneg. So we did two direct blow-ups on an old debris blow-up machine. And what that was like is every single splice would jump when it went from the AB rolls. So the 35 mil prints of that are pretty hideous looking. But ultimately, it played around the world and ended up getting its little cult audience and still is one of the movies that some people only know me for that movie.
So that's pretty, that's a pretty good, memorable early film. I mean, you know, you're a filmmaker. So I would say that, I mean, since then, you've actually, you know, I'm just going to list a few of the films that people know you for. Is Antiviral, Hyena Road, Biba Boys, The Captured Bird, The Theater Bazaar, and, of course, The Hobo with a Shotgun. So you've actually, obviously, graduated and are working with more established directors and filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, the films I just listed are actually quite different. They're quite diverse. And I was wondering, you know, what makes you decide to do a project?
Well, I think basically it depends on the director. That's number one, that I want to watch the director's movies, what they've done, hear what they have to say. The screenplay is, of course, a deciding factor. Anytime I read a screenplay, I visualize it and visualize the possibilities and then speak with the director afterwards and see what they have in mind. And we try to find something to mesh into a cohesive vision prior to hitting the floor. I don't like to show up and just sort of wing it. I mean, I can if need be. That's not a problem. But I do like to have a very concise mise-en-scène worked out prior to hitting the floor. And most of the directors I work with are perfectly happy doing that. And my most successful movies, we had shot listed prior to actually hitting on the floor and had a very precise plan that we can change, if need be, on the day. That always happens. But I think as long as you and the director have a very concise mise-en-scène philosophy, and that's what's important, you find what is the philosophy of the movie. In terms of the lighting, in terms of the progression, is it the same thing all throughout, or does the lighting and look and photography and framing adapt and change as the movies go along? I mean, you know, even on a picture I did called Rupture, which was with a director named Steven Schoenberg, who did this movie Secretary, you may have heard of, and Fur, the Nicole Kidman, Deanne Arbus movie. We had a very precise framing chart made for that movie where actually the lead character is played by Noomi Rapace, and she would move from the corner of frames at the beginning of the movie, and then the framing would gradually center her as it went on because the character would learn actually her true self, who she really is, and then the ending of the movie ends with her always in the crosshairs. And the depth of field would change where it would start in anamorphic, then switch to spherical once an event happens. And then we would start in spherical with Cook five eyes, and they would be starting at 1.3, and then every scene, the depth of field would increase so that the end of the film would be in deep focus. So, you know, those kinds of plans we meticulously work out for movies. There are things that the audience won't necessarily notice, but they will subconsciously feel. Like if you see, for example, Rupture, you see the ending of the movie has a very, very different feel than the beginning, and you don't quite know how to place it, but it puts the audience a bit at unease. that movie in general, I think, put the audience a little bit unease, even though I like it quite a bit. But it wasn't one that resonated with the kids necessarily.
So do you tend to gravitate towards more of the horror genre.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that comes from? I'm just curious because I've you know, seen some of your work and I've seen some of the horror stuff. And it's like, it's mm-hmm. definitely in that genre. And I'd be curious because you seem like a very normal person. But what is hidden within you, DPs, that maybe that particularly like that?
Well, I think it's all storytelling. I think cinematography is storytelling, as always, from the beginning. And when you work with directors that are great collaborators, it could be a wonderful melding of the minds in terms of storytelling. And everybody, I think, has a way to use cinema as catharsis, as a storyteller. And for me, you know, I grew up in a very, let's say, not recommended to grow up in city called Ottawa. Growing up in Ottawa, there was in the suburbs of Ottawa, I mean, I learned everything I needed to know about hidden darkness. Like, everything was so clean and so polished. And I came from a, you know, pretty unusual family that I had a Catholic mother who was whiter than these walls over here. And I had a Pakistani father who was pretty, pretty dark skinned, you know, and he was a Muslim. So having a Muslim father and a Catholic mother, just having that racial mix automatically made me different. My name was different. Certainly in the early 90s when the Gulf War stuff happened and all that, then I started to get all the wonderful sort of racism and stuff that we all learn about as we grow older, you know, and then all that stuff sort of came in. And I always knew there was something different about me. And there was something about the night in Ottawa that I felt was a lie, because it wasn't that bright a city. There wasn't that much bounce from all the, well, mercury vapor when I was growing up, and then eventually the sodium vapor lights bouncing against the sky, the clouds in the sky at night to reflect back light. It was pitch black. And then that darkness of the sky told me that there's something hidden in the soul of this city. And it certainly, growing up, I saw that. You know, there was a lot of really dark kids doing really screwed up things. And the genre was just something I gravitated to. I mean, you know, since I can remember, I was into like the Hammer Draculas, which were, and the Universal Monster movies, of course, of the 30s were the ones that really were formative for me. Certainly seeing Edgar Ulmer's The Black Cat, which features a scene where Bela Lugosi is fleeing Boris Karloff, you know, in shadow. But like, those things were pretty pretty formative for a youngster like myself. And I was very into Edgar Allan Poe and alienated just by proxy. And I was obsessed with cinema. I was very depressed by being a child. I think childhood is a completely embarrassing, horrible thing to live through. The way I could get through that was an obsession with cinema that still lasts today.
So I guess you must have tips for shooting blood.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're following the old Dick Smith formula, which is a formula that Dick Smith, who's the makeup artist behind movies like The Exorcist, Little Big Man, like so many seminal makeup movies of the 70s, he just, it's basically corn syrup and food coloring. You know, you learn things as things go on, how to not make it too pink. You put some yellow in it. You put green. Green is actually the formula to not make it too
Do you still test it? Like, if you're prepping for a film, do you still do some blood testing?
Rarely, because the special makeup artists, or, I mean, there's different departments. I mean, if you're making a union picture now, different people will put blood on different elements. Whereas before, when we were doing our underground horror movies, it was all in the special makeup. We just put blood on everything. Whereas now the union rules are a wee bit different. So every department now, the practical special effects department, the special makeup effects department, and the costume department all have their bloods. And the straight makeup people too. You gotta have a lot of blood conversation, but there are a lot of the same products and materials advanced beyond all that. Probably my favorite blood is a blood called Fleet Street, which is really good stuff. expensive though, so but Fleet Street's pretty neat.
I mean, the horror genre being sort of one you gravitate towards, but when you're approaching High in a Road and, let's say, Beba Boys, just for example, mm-hmm. they're out of that genre and they're different. Do you go outside maybe your basic approach to your package, or do you really cater your lens package and camera package to each particular shoot? Is there a go-to package that you have that you started with?
No, every single movie is different, and every single movie has its different lighting requirements, camera requirements, lens requirements. It's important for me that every single movie looks different, and they do. You know, they radically do. sometimes to extremes, that also if somebody doesn't like, say, one movie I've made, then maybe they could look at another one and see, you know, I don't believe in always just doing the same thing and doing the same kind of lighting or whatever. I tailor it to the director's style, the director's interests, and also what the screenplay requires. And I approach everything from a narrative perspective. So the light is a narrative tool and has to reflect the character's inner psychology, but also where the story is going. And it's perfectly okay for the light to change and adapt as the movie goes along. Something that if you see any of my movies, you can actually see a subtle progression in all the lighting and camera techniques as they go along to better reflect the character's psychological states. So if I'm not doing a horror movie, I don't approach it in any way different than I do if I'm doing a genre picture. It's still filmmaking, still storytelling.
Yeah, and DPs really are chameleons.
Yeah, and you have to be.
Yeah, you have to be, exactly. Yeah. I always find it interesting when if directors or producers are looking for a DP and they go, oh, well, they don't do this or they don't do that. How could they do this? Whereas, no, any talented DP can basically do whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. And that's for me, something I do my best to do is as long as we're all on the same page as to what the movie is and what the story is and what, you know, sort of is the visual reflection of the psychological states of the character, I can do anything. And I think, you know, most DPs will do the same.
Do you use a DIT all the time?
Yes. Yeah, I do. It's basically now that's the film laboratory. I do not, however, use very elaborate LUTs when I work. I'm usually just using a Rec. 709 LUT, very simple. And then sometimes we'll just sculpt it, but they usually just start with straight Rec. 709, which for me is like a one light film transfer because I come from the film world. I approach things very much in a similar way. Your film stock is now just your camera sensor and your different camera with its different attributes. But I still use a light meter. I just have learned to adapt my light meter to the different sensitivities of the different chips and the different camera systems, knowing how their latitude works versus what my light meter is telling me. I still use a meter, you know, at least for the beginning of it. Then you have to fine tune it just taking a look at the monitor, because there's some things that the meter will sometimes change depending on how certainly an Alexa will take it. But you can certainly rough in a very large lighting scene with your meter and then adapt it to the monitor. So, but I always go off of 709 and Sony OLED monitors are my way to do it. But I also use my meter and I also use my eyeballs. I don't use waveforms or anything like that. I could tell what the latitude's like. I've been in enough grading suites to know, you know, the Alexa, as with, you know, many DPs, is my favorite camera still. So I know exactly if I can hold that highlight, if I can't, you know.
But the lenses in combination with the Alexa probably are going to have an effect. Are there
absolutely
favorite package of lenses?
Well, these days, my favorite spherical lens is the Canon K35s, which are 70s era lenses. They're used on things like Handmaid's Tale and things like that. They're old. They're really painful to work for camera assistants. You know, they're not a very easy lens to use. For certain stuff, I really like them. I mean, if I'm asked to do a more Hollywood-y kind of look, I would probably go for Cook S4s if I'm asked to do that kind of like super clean thing. I use a lot of zoom lenses. I know some people are allergic to zoom lenses. I love them completely respect the voyeuristic aspects of them, because all cinema is in a certain way voyeurism. I have no problem using zoom lenses. I use a lot of ingenue. Zooms are primarily what I use. I think ingenue has come out with really lovely new short zooms, the EZ short zooms that are actually relatively cheap even to buy. And I used them on a movie called Random Acts of Violence recently, and they were great. You have to knock them down and diffuse, I think, a lot of stuff down, or use a lot of older lenses to counteract the sort of harshness and sharpness of digital, even on the Alexa. So in terms of zoom lenses, I have an old ingenue 25-250. Lucky Pierre is that lens's nickname, which is a lens that has fungus in its rear elements, so it creates a very distinctive softness that I've used on a few movies recently. And Lucky Pierre is good fun, and that's, you know, a lot of old technology, and it's tough to get a matte box to put on it. Well, yeah, it's really hard because yeah, it's not a correct size that fits any of them. But you know, those things aside, with using the older lenses, I think they're good. And in anamorphics, I like very much Kawa anamorphics, actually. If you get a really good set of Kawas, and you'll always know if you get a good set of Kawas if the 100 millimeter isn't completely insane and can actually focus the image wide open, which used to be Claremont, now it's Keslo. They have a really good set of Rehouse Kawas.
Have you tried any of the lenses that have been made in China?
The Sigmas and things like that.
Because I think the Chinese are...
The Zine new lenses. Look, I mean, they're still pretty sharp. They're fine for certain things. I know Sigma is trying to do cinema primes, and Zine have put out kind of relatively affordable sets of primes. I played around with them, but still not my thing. Like, even Leica... primes. Some people are thinking they're great. I find them too perfect. I don't like perfection. I've never enjoyed perfection. I am an extremely imperfect human being, and I've always admired the imperfections in people and in lenses. For me, that's interesting. That's where the interests are. The flaws are where truth is. It's probably one of the reasons why I like all these junky old lenses that became trendy again, because it's a way to counter the harshness of digital, but at the same time, very, very complicated for poor camera assistants.
How much can you talk about random acts of violence?
I could talk about it to an extent. It's Jay Baruchel's new feature. It's a very different movie from certainly Goon 2, which is his previous feature as a director. Jay's phenomenal. He's one of the great directors that I've worked with. And really, you know, that movie was just all good vibes. It was one of those great shoots. And I've been lucky enough to have a few of them where everybody's friends. We're all together doing something that we all believe in, and Random Acts is certainly a lot of color. It's a lot of lighting. It's a lot of big lighting setups for its budget, certainly. And, you know, I've seen cuts of it, and I love it. I think it's dynamite. I think it's some of the best stuff I've done in years. Like, it's a very dreamy movie. It's a movie about the morality of creating artwork based on true crime, which is very interesting. The movie actually has a meaning. It's not just, you know, horror scenes put together.
Right, for the sake of horror scenes.
Yeah, which is fine, but it actually is a meditation on the genre, which is interesting, particularly comic books, you know, not to give away the plot or anything, but the lead character is a comic book artist, and then he finds somebody's recreating the deaths in his comic book in reality. And it goes a little bit deeper than that, but there are definite debates in that movie about doing sort of a cynical version of what in the 2000s people called torture porn, and about the morality of doing that, movies like Hostel or whatever. And so for me, it's interesting because as a horror fan, those are things that one thinks about, especially if you're diving into such dark material, the morality of doing that oneself as a storyteller. So the movie's very much about that. And Jay is like top-notch director and really sets a really good tone and vibe on set. And that movie was meticulously planned out. We did 6 drafts of the shot list before we hit the floor. And it was really, really planned out because it was only a 20-day shoot. And the budget wasn't tiny, but these days, even if your budget isn't minuscule, you might end up, if you have big setups and big scenes and big overhead, you'll probably end up with a 20-something day shoot. This one in particular was 20 days. And even then, some of our days were very abbreviated. It was almost like the equivalent of 18 normal hour day shoots.
Was that shot in Montreal or in Toronto?
It was shot in Toronto, outside of Toronto. It was a regional tax credit movie, so we were shooting in places like Lindsay, Ontario, and things like that.
Based on your website and just visiting some of the horror films that you have done, I get a sense that the narratives actually are a little bit more than a superficial narrative. There's a little bit more, it's a little deeper, and that's good.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's important that I just go out and do a sequel to something, not like there's anything wrong with certain sequels, but, you know, for me, it has to mean something, because also I'm such a horror fan, and I prefer art house genre films. I think the genre is such an amazing way to be incredibly political, reflect on the political topics of the day, and the genre has always done on that, even going back down to the 50s, where, you know, it might not be necessarily the right end of the coin, but, you know, there was a whole lot of paranoia, Cold War paranoia, and the movies reflected that. Then in the 70s, there were very anti-Vietnam War movies, like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is quite an anti-Vietnam movie, Night of the Living Dead, a very radical movie about race relations and things like that. You know, they're very political movies in the 70s, as most stuff was. And a lot of the great genre movies that inspired me were those movies that went out in that decadence and tried to have a political narrative and also maybe something deeper than the superficial boo stuff. That stuff isn't really my beat. I like stuff that means something. So for me, the genre is a wonderful portal into going into storytelling that you wouldn't be allowed to to do under other circumstances. And, you know, I've never made the most evident commercial genre movie. I mean, even something like, if you see a movie like We Are Still Here, you would think, okay, this is a little haunted house movie, but it's a little haunted house movie about older people, you know, about older people with adult things going on. And that was sort of the difference, because normally it'd be a bunch of kind of kids in a house, but no, these are parents that have lost their kids, sort of doing adult things. And you know, that for me is the difference of that movie that makes it interesting, is it's a middle-aged horror movie, which isn't really done these days.
I think, you know, when I was looking at that film, I think I have to get beyond the scare factor, mm-hmm. because those kind of films do scare me.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand it. You know, it's your comfort zone, and it's a lot of people's comfort zone. But for the uninitiated, it's like sort of getting through that so you can see what you're talking about.
Of course. But, you know, We're Still Here was a tiny, tiny, tiny movie done in upstate New York that ended up hitting big suddenly out of nowhere. And it ended up being quite successful. And that kind of thing, it was just made amongst friends and things like that. But at the same time, there's a little something to it. I mean, that's the one that probably out of all the movies I've done follows the most horror archetype ABCD stuff. But at the same time, it tries to do something a little bit different with them. We always try, you know, I can't say we always succeed, but we do our best, you know, and we just see if people like them.
When did you receive your letters?
That was probably early 2013. I received my letters then. It was after Antiviral. I had shot two episodes of a TV show called Hannibal, and I sent in all my movies and everything.
Oh, yes, Hannibal. And, see, I saw that on your reel, and I'm like, that looks like Hannibal. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I shot two episodes of that, yeah.
But Antiviral, I really liked Antiviral.
Oh, cheers.
And I thought that, you know, it was very clean.
Mm-hmm.
But of course everything was white, so when the blood does come, it's like, it's quite shocking.
Yeah, that was the idea.
It worked.
Cheers.
On your demo, what's the one with Lawrence Fishburne? There's a couple.
That's Hannibal. He's in Hannibal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. That stuff, you know, Hannibal was a very corporate job in a way, and that was in very interesting education versus coming from the independent feature world, seeing how things go over on that kind of thing. And it was fine. You know, I learned a lot on Hannibal. If I can avoid, like, I can do corporate stuff, no problem, but I like to do it on a certain level where there's maybe a few less people fighting behind the scenes. But hey, you know, that is something that can be dealt with as well. You know, it's all about the ultimate product, whereas that's more a corporate sort of TV show job, whereas on a feature where the director actually is the one in charge and everything, at least in terms of the content, that's something different where you can have a bit more of a say as to how things go. But something like Antiviral, for example, the concept behind Antiviral, it's directed by Brandon Cronenberg, who's one of my great friends and great collaborators in life. You know, that movie, the idea was it's between a trip to the doctor and a fashion shoot. And that was the look of the movie. So we shot on the Alexa, and the Alexa was actually a pretty new camera at the time we shot it. Not a lot of movies had been done on it, and it was still only 1080. You couldn't even shoot 2K on it at the time we did it. And that particular movie we shot on Ultra Primes, which are very sharp lenses, sharp German lenses, but they have a little bit more romance to them than, say, for example, a Master Prime, which for me is, I'm not a huge fan of them because they're really clinical. On digital in particularly, like if it's film, you have the layer of film to soften them up. But we embrace that on Antiviral. Use zero diffusion, nothing, and just used the Ultra Prime straight up. And sometimes, you know, didn't do totally shallow depth of field. We did the one thing that's very not trendy today. We actually did deep focus, whereas back in the day on film, everyone was like, you know, get the thickest stop you can, because you didn't know if you would, you know, like I started out without video assists, you know, and they weren't super expensive movies. It's like, you know, if it was out of focus, then that's your shot. We didn't have the money to go back and reshoot stuff. So, you know, that's why so many movies back in the day had out of focus shots. I mean, and also when the video assists came in, they were so terrible, you couldn't tell what was going on them. So that's a thing, right? Like people, a lot of younger people have no idea how easier it is to make a movie today. It's a completely different thing.
Yeah, the landscape is totally different. Everybody can shoot something,
mm-hmm.
but being good at it is a different thing, and they learn in different ways, or they may never get the discipline to do it efficiently.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad I was able to learn without even knowing what autofocus was. You know, training on, like, even Super 8, which obviously had more depth of field, because smaller your negative, the more depth of field you have. But, you know, even then, you have to train, I'm walking back, and turn the lens in consequence to your physical movements as an operator, which, you know, was very good in 16 mil. My first feature, you know, I focused it myself as I was operating. And that was just based on knowing we had, at the time, it was a 16 mil. So we had the Ingenue 12 to 120. Then sometimes they had a 10 to 150 that we're using. It was all in zooms. You know, again, I was not afraid of zooms. And today I am not afraid of zooms. I like them. And you know, you would just train in terms of your distance, the object you're shooting to, where you were turning with the lens. So you got to know the lens so well, because all you were using for the whole show. So that kind of training, certainly, even though I barely even touch the camera anymore, because I have operators who are operating on most of the movies I do, you know, I'm still really hands-on. Like, I wear gloves when I shoot, because I'll go and I'll adjust a lot of fine-tuning of the lamps myself. You know, I'll go in there, I'll get down and dirty if need be, and, you know, I'm very proactive. I don't just sit behind in a tent. I don't use a monitor separate from the director. I'm always beside the director at all times.
And that's probably a good practice. Well, just to keep in it. And I think, considering where you come from, it makes sense that you would never be hands-off.
No, and that's the thing. And for me, hiding in a tent away from the director is unthinkable to me. Like, you know, in the director's monitor, they just get used to having the remote iris controllers beside, and we're all together. The director and the script supervisor, and usually there's a couple of producers behind us, or the first AD will be there occasionally, but it's a very tight-knit group, and for me, everything's for the director, and I think that is because I had directed in the past, and I approach any movie of treat your director with the same respect you would have wanted to have been treated as a director. I don't do it anymore, and really don't want to do it anymore, directing films, but that lesson taught me really how to respect my directors, and not only that, know their problems and know how to help them.
Every DP should probably be able to direct something at some point, just to have the shoe on the other foot.
Yeah. Well, you need to know exactly what their problems are and where you can support them and where you can help them. For me, it's I don't believe in problems. I believe in solutions, and solutions that are come up in a timely manner. You know, especially budgets are getting lower and lower these days, and you're having less and less time to shoot, unless you're in TV where all this money is being thrown out everywhere. You're doing a studio feature where people waste money to a rather shocking degree. You know, when you're doing the more sort of independent movies that aren't that cheap, but which is more my wheelhouse, but not $40, $50, $60 million. I can easily do one of them, but, you know, you want to keep stuff within a realm where the director will have some power. That, for me, is important. I don't want to see my directors screwed over. And it's happened a bunch of times, you know, that we went out to try to make a good movie, then it was taken over in post, and the director wasn't there. And then, you know, in the best movies I've done, that was never the case.
Speaking sort of that post situation after a film and a director, the film being taken away from them, mm-hmm. What about you as your work? Are you involved right to the end to ensure
as much as I can? I mean, it's more often than not, I do the color grading all the way through, and I'm very, very, very involved with that. You know, even back in the day with old color timing, and you would just talk to somebody and then they would show up with another print that cost a fortune. You know, like I was always involved with the grading, and I still am. You know, the grading for me is very important. That also, if I cannot be there, I send notes, and then they send me stuff, and then I'll send more notes on it and do a back and forth in that way. Or if I can't be there for the entire color grading process, I try to at least show up for a weekend to set everything up. And then afterwards, they send me stuff for approval. So yes, I'm very, very, very hands-on throughout that process. Of course, you know, it's a little awkward when you're color grading a movie where the director's basically been removed in post-production on, which happened to me once on a picture I did. It was the first time I had actually a large, for a Canadian, well, it was not really a Canadian movie, it was an American movie, but a movie called Walled In. That was the first time I had $8 million to play with, which for somebody coming from my highest budget prior to Walled In was $1.2 million. So going from $1.2 million to, I think it was $8 something million, and today, if that movie was going to be made, it would be 20-something. Huge sets, really elaborate thing. It was done in Regina back when they had a tax credit, and that was going on. So going from that situation, shooting, that was on 35 mil, so it was a different process back then, but it was still the beginning of the DI process as we know it. So we, you know, we're still color grading it in the DI way on a big screen with, you know, on a luster, I believe that was on a luster. And, you know, the director wasn't there. So...
But they kept you involved.
They kept me involved. They kept me involved.
And through to the end, which is...
Then they did whatever they wanted. They kept me there for, I think, 4 days. I roughed stuff in, then they did a whole bunch of stuff without me and didn't actually complete the color grading. You know, there's a lot of shots in the climax of that movie that I said, okay, so you're going to match this when I'm gone. And they just said, no one's going to notice. Stopped it, and they didn't match the shots. So, you know, that can happen sometimes. And that's when a producer's just sort of disrespect towards the director is unfortunate. But it can happen.
Okay, I have one final question. Is there anything you don't go to set without?
My light meter, that's number one. My gaffer's glass, number two. All the old person stuff. Number three, probably my second light meter, because if one dies, I will use the other. My eyeballs, I tend to bring those. My gloves these days. Since I started using gloves, I need gloves.
Well, if you're going to be playing with some hot lights.
Yeah, exactly. I usually go out over there with them. I try to bring water, a canister of water with me, because the amount of waste for plastic bottles on a film set is pretty hairy. So I try to be as environmentally good as possible. And because I'm a vegetarian and a lot of the subs they bring around when you're shooting they'll always have a vegetarian thing. But I've learned that on certain sets, they'll pile up sandwiches on a tray and then people are all coughing and all have Ebola. And then they go and they look at the set. Do I want this one? They touch one sandwich. They put it back. They go back. So I learned pretty quickly, bring your own snacks.
Yeah, I think that's probably the surest way. If you have any dietary concerns, just suck it up and bring your own hermetically sealed food to come out when you need it.
Well, also another thing you got to remember when you're the DP of a movie or a TV show or whatever, you're usually running around like a chicken without its head. So anytime the subs show up and everybody sort of sits back and they're on safari and grabs the subs, you're rushing to get that setup done. You're speaking with the director on what... You don't have time.
Yeah.
And I'm not somebody who works well talking about other topics other than the scene at hand on set. I don't like story time on set. Story time is for lunch. I don't like a lot of chatter around the camera. I like a lot of very focused, precise approach to filmmaking. You know,
and that sounds fair. I mean, you're there to do a job.
Yeah, and I expect people to, you know, do that. I also bring my sense of humor, and I bring something that is very important to me, a good working environment. I don't believe that people work best under stress or fear. I think that is absolutely the wrong approach. Some people think that is the only way to get results. I firmly disagree. So another one of the things I like to bring with me on every set is a good working environment where people are happy. Because I think if people are respected and happy, they'll just work better, they'll be happier, and the results will be on screen. The very best movies I've made, I do not believe at all in this, the artist must suffer to create a great piece of artwork. Stuff. The very best movies I've made were done under good working conditions when people were happy to be there and actually wanted to be there. So time has proven that myth to be false. And the movies that were made under extreme duress, where people weren't happy to be there, have been the worst movies I've made. And I think it's important to, you know, make everybody feel like they're a part of the process, because then that contribution they're adding to the movie will be all the more special.
Well, and that's why people that are working in film really want to be a part of a filmmaking.
Yeah, correct. You know,
and so why not make it more worth their while by being a part of it? I mean, you work for the credit up there because you're a part of it. So feeling a part of it while you're actually making it is a good thing.
I think so. And, you know, it's very important, I would say, to understand that movies are sensitive. That they will reflect the ambient you put around. It used to be a more chemical process where you're doing a very alchemical thing, trapping light into chemicals. in a certain way. And there's still some sort of weird alchemy to it. And I believe that sort of the ambience you put around the cameras and the ambience you put around everybody, that alchemy will rub off on the final product.
And you, in your position as a DP, you know, you're at a core. You know, there's several cores on a set, mm-hmm. but you're at a core that you can radiate that positive energy, you know, and helps it.
Absolutely. I think the DP in many ways has to be the sort of cheerleader of the set, the one that that helps move things along. And also the DP is the main arbitrator to really ensure the director's wishes are being followed, at least on a visual level. The DP is in many ways a mediator between the director, and some directors are very hands-on and will do that job themselves, or other directors are more introverted and will just sort of stay behind the monitor or just whisper stuff to their heads of department and then just sort of say yes or no. You know, you adapt to every single director's sensitivities, but in order for that director to get their vision across, I think the DP has to be their biggest cheerleader and their biggest supporter. And when the impossible adverse things come to challenge them, you have to be there to help them and come up with suggestions. Like if they're sitting there saying, I don't know what to do here, you're like, okay, well, here are some potential things we can do, and just help them. Because if you're not going to help your director, who are you going to help?
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.